Happy Monday and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast.
It's alive! It's alive!
That, of course, is the Biden campaign after a convincing win in South Carolina. But, of course, these bounces only last for a short period of time, and we have the Super Tuesday vote tomorrow, and the polls are all over the place. Well, speaking of polls, we wanted to dive into this, and so we are joined by my fellow Cheesehead, fellow Wisconsinite, Charles Franklin, who is the director of the Marquette University Law School Poll, professor emeritus of University of Wisconsin at Madison, and an all-around polling nerd. So, Charles, thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Charlie. It's great to be on.
This is so weird because I'm in Wisconsin and you're in New York, and we're two Wisconsinites talking about all of this. So let's just talk about polling. And you know, people who are familiar with the Marquette University poll, it is regarded as the gold standard here in Wisconsin. And so we'll talk about that in some detail. But you know, this is a tough year for polling. Did anybody get the South Carolina primary number right? I know there were some in the last couple of days showing relatively, you know, that Biden was going to win, but he was going to win by a modest margin. I don't think anybody called 30 points, did they?
I'm not sure anybody hit 30. I believe there were some that were pretty large Biden wins. But the point, I think, is that in the primaries especially, it's a moving target that moves incredibly fast. If you're not doing polling practically every week, not to say every few days, you're always going to run the risk of being behind the curve. A good debate, or especially a bad debate, matters. The outcome of the Nevada caucuses matter. And now South Carolina has, I think, reshifted things so much that we can look at last week's polls as where the race stood then, and we can use them to measure where the race will stand after tomorrow, and how much it shifted. But it's moving so fast. The other thing is, when you're looking at a general election, people's preferences between a Democrat and a Republican are pretty well set. Mm-hmm. When you're looking within a party, you're looking at several candidates, all of whom could be acceptable to most Democrats in this case, or Republicans in a different year. And so that also adds another layer of volatility. So Mayor Pete drops out. Where does his vote go? Biden has a good night. How much can he pull in from that, from a group of voters who are not diehard supporters or opponents of a lot of these folks, but are looking for the best nominee for their party and are willing to make shifts if they need to?
No, so you have those two things. Number one, you know, events take place, so they move the numbers. And then, of course, you have this extraordinary level of fluidity. Fair to say that as we're sitting here on Monday, that we probably should take most of the Super Tuesday polls that were conducted last week and kind of push them aside. They're a little bit stale. As you point out, they're snapshots. They're not predictions.
No, these are for information purposes only. They are not predictions. And you know, no poll really could have done an adequate job of picking up what happened on Saturday and reflecting Sunday and Monday data. If you did a poll in just one day, you missed a whole lot of people that you can't get on the first night. And anything that's older than that includes all the pre-South Carolina results, or the South Carolina opinion, which, you know, is completely out of date today.
So do we have any idea, based on what you've seen in terms of, you know, first choice, second choice, the trend lines, what is the effect of Mayor Pete dropping out Sunday? Do we even have any idea where that's going? Because a lot of opinion, you know, a lot of pundits have very, very confident opinions where those votes are going. But I've been looking at some of the numbers, and of course, I'm not the data, you know, guy that you are. But it would seem to not necessarily be a clear black and white picture.
I think that most of the polling that has asked people's second choices has found that the Buttigieg vote is fairly dispersed across the field. In contrast, the Warren voters are pretty positive to Bernie Sanders as their second choice. But the Buttigieg folks have been a little more spread around the field. I think that means that it's unlikely to go in a big lump to any one candidate, but more likely to be spread out. I think we often get caught up in the idea of lanes, and somehow Buttigieg has been cast as the moderate lane. That doesn't mean that all of the folks that support him wouldn't go to Warren or Sanders as a second choice. So the bottom line is, I don't think he makes a big difference. The difference he makes is that whatever percentage of the vote he's going to get, would have gotten, is now dispersed among the other candidates, and that helps all of the others reach the 15% threshold that they need to start amassing delegates.
Yeah, this is crucial to understand tomorrow, because these are not winner-take-all primaries, but they could be if other candidates don't get to that 15% threshold. So if a candidate A, gets 14%, they're out, right? They get nothing.
Right.
Whereas if they get 16% or 17%, then they're in the market for some delegates. So there's a lot of gamesmanship that can go on in terms of these numbers.
It is. And a lot of that is totally beyond the view of voters, right? I mean, I struggle to keep up with these rules, yeah. And I'll tell you right up that I don't know all these rules as well as I might. But for the average voter, probably the best strategy is really the simplest one. Go and vote for the candidate you like best, because the strategizing is simply too complicated to have much idea of how to vote strategically if you were trying to do that.
So before we get into Wisconsin, because I want to take a deep dive into what people don't understand about Wisconsin or what they do, where Wisconsin is trending this year, staying with polls, we have so many different polls that come out, and there's been some effort to rate them and rank them based on which ones are the most valid, which ones have the best track record. In your mind, what's the best way to explain how a layperson should evaluate the good polls versus the polls that ought to be viewed with a great deal of skepticism?
You know, this is a very hard thing to do. Folks like me that do this for a living have a hard time articulating to people what are the characteristics of a good poll versus a bad poll. In the end, I think there's some advantage to a rating system like Nate Silver at 538 does. Not that I think it's perfect, but at least it's a serious attempt to capture the past performance of polls. But even there, you're talking about a pretty deep dive to get an idea. You know, live telephone calls that include a whole lot of cell phones are still, you know, the gold standard, but internet-based polling is getting better. Quite good in some cases. And there's skepticism about the automated polls that are based on robocalls and so on. But some years they've had a pretty good track record too. So there's just not a simple rule. What I would come back to is look at the polls in comparison with one another. So if you've got, as we had in Wisconsin this past week or so, three polls all done at sort of a similar time, you can go to a place like Real Clear Politics or 538 that has a nice simple table. You can see all the recent polls in Wisconsin. And you can see to the extent to which these polls agree with each other versus disagree with each other. That doesn't absolutely clarify which one is right and which one is wrong, but at least it gives an interested political observer the understanding that here are two that pretty much agree with each other, and here's one that's pretty far away. Maybe at that point you want to go back and look at the previous three or four polls in that state and try to get a sense of where the average is. It's always better to average a bunch of polls rather than focus on just one. And even if one's an outlier, it won't move the average too much. But if you focus on each newest poll, you're going to chase outliers if you don't put them in the perspective of recent polls by other organizations.
Okay, let's dive right into Wisconsin, because you were out last week, last Thursday, with the latest poll of Wisconsin. Not a surprise. Very, very, very close race in Wisconsin, a state that could actually determine the outcome of the election. And basically, the top line, I mean, everything's within the margin of error. Bernie Sanders with a 2-point edge over Trump, Biden, Buttigieg, Klobuchar were tied. Bloomberg was behind by 1 point. Warren was behind by 3 points. And again, just sort of the knife's edge. So give me your sense of where Wisconsin is. Wisconsin was decided by about 23,000 votes 4 years ago. It's going to be close again this year, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. two things. One is what you just said about our last poll. All of those are inside the margin of error. And they're also pretty consistent with what we've seen in six polls we've done since August, which were, with a couple of exceptions, all within the margin of error and a little bit of variation. A Democrat or two who were slightly ahead of Trump, Trump slightly ahead of another Democrat or two. Sometimes the Democrats are, as a group, doing a little bit better. Sometimes Trump is doing a little bit better. But it's all margin of error stuff and, you know, pulling hairs out of your head over these minor differences is a big mistake, especially for people not from Wisconsin. Let me stress, three of our last five presidential elections were decided by less than one percentage point. And in fact, the 23,000 vote margin in 2016 was the largest vote margin of those three close elections. Only the two Obama elections were not really close. And our governor's race last year, in 2018 rather, was decided by 1.1 percentage points. So I think those are the kinds of margins we're really realistically looking at, unless something dramatic changes over the next 10 months.
Wisconsin's sometimes hard to explain to people who aren't around the state because, you know, it has such contrast. I mean, historically, this is the state that gave us fighting Bob La Follette, but also Joe McCarthy. We have arguably one of the most liberal United States senators, Tammy Baldwin, and one of the most conservatives, Ron Johnson. So you have these very, very progressive politicians, and then you have people like Scott Walker, and they're not contradictory. Now, let me just run something by you, because what I did before 2016, I would often explain Wisconsin as having two different political personalities. One in general elections, which were generally won, the quadrennial election, generally won by Democrats, and the off-year election, where Republicans did much better. But that's changing. And in 2016, to the surprise of a lot of folks, you had Donald Trump narrowly winning Wisconsin. Ron Johnson won by a relatively more comfortable margin. And this was in with a larger electorate. So it used to be that the larger electorate trended Democratic, smaller electorate voted Republican. But this is a state in transition, isn't it?
It is. And at multiple levels. I think one part of that is the role that socioeconomic status plays in turnout, which, of course, is hugely different between presidential and midterms. So younger folks turn out a lot less than older folks. And in midterm elections, that's especially true. People with lower levels of education turn out less in low turnout elections than those with higher education. Economic status also plays a role in this. So one of the things that we're seeing shift a bit is that as Republicans have gained strength with especially white working class voters, they've improved their performance in high turnout presidential elections, but they may then suffer from having a group of voters who are on average less likely to turn out in a midterm. Democrats are going the other way. They're gaining strength with college graduates and especially those with a graduate degree. And that's balancing out the traditional Republican strength in college-educated suburbs.
Okay, I want to talk about the geographical shift in Wisconsin as well. Now, after 2016, a lot of the attention was focused on the fact that the Democratic vote in Milwaukee County was down about 40,000 votes from the last presidential election. The implication being that African Americans had not turned out for Hillary Clinton, and that 40,000 votes explained the 23,000 vote loss statewide. But also, maybe the larger picture is the shift of northern and western Wisconsin, which really has been trending much more dramatically Republican. So I saw one analysis that said that Republicans had, the Democrats had lost 250,000 votes in rural Wisconsin, which really dwarfs the shortfall in Democratic Milwaukee County.
That's right. I think the downturn in turnout in Milwaukee is an important story, but it's become presented as if that's the whole story of the election, and it's very much not the whole story. The shift, if you can imagine Wisconsin, there's a diagonal from Green Bay in the northeast down to the Iowa border in the southwest. And to the northwest of that diagonal, counties have been becoming more Republican in elections since 2012. And this is multiple elections. It's not just Trump. It's also the governor's race, but it's also races like Tammy Baldwin's Senate race, which she won very strongly. But the Northwest moved against her even more than they had been before. Contrast that with the Southeast, which includes Milwaukee and all the Milwaukee suburbs, but also includes Madison and Dane County and bigger suburban counties around Green Bay. Almost all of those counties have become a bit less Republican since 2012. And what I mean by that is they're still giving majorities to the GOP, but instead of the Republicans winning by big margins, they're winning by 10 to 15 points less on the margin. So that's about like, you know, you were winning the county by 75% and now you're winning it by 66 or 67%.
And this would be the wow counties, right? Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington County. This used to be the engine of Republican votes in Wisconsin. And they still are, you know, big vaults for Republican votes, but those margins are down now.
That's exactly right. And in fact, because they're the engine in part because they're both very Republican, but they're also pretty populous. There's a lot of people that are there, so that really helps. But Ozaukee County, one of those, was the biggest swing from the margin they gave Walker in 2014 to the margin they gave him in 2018. They were down almost 15 percentage
really?
Points in the margin there. Second biggest swing.
That's my
was
county,
Waukesha.
By the way. I live in Ozaukee County.
There you go.
But I'm not to blame for that. I'm not responsible for that.
I wouldn't think so. But Waukesha was the second biggest swing. Then the direction was Dane County, that's where Madison is, which is the fastest growing county in population. And as Democratic as it has historically been, it's giving even bigger margins to Democrats. But this shift of the always reliable wow counties not giving as big a margin matters tremendously in a statewide race because it means that margin now has to be made up somewhere else. Right now, it's being made up in the Northwest. Those rural counties are very thinly populated, but cumulatively, they make up around 30% or a shade more of the statewide voter population. So, you know, around Milwaukee and that vicinity, it's more like about 40% or more of the population. But these two can play off one another, and that's where we're uncertain going into 2020. How big is turnout in the rural North, and how Republican can it be? How pro-Trump can it be? And in the Southeast, are we seeing reservations that may hold down that suburban vote for Trump, as we saw elsewhere? You know, using 2018 as the example. The other side of the story is Republicans have really come home to Trump in the state. In our latest poll of people who are pure Republicans, they just say, I'm a Republican, 95% job approval. We've seen that in the high 80s and low 90s, but this is the first time we saw.
I find this fascinating, as you might expect that I would, considering how Trump skeptical Wisconsin Republicans were. This was the one state that really turned against Trump during the primary. He lost here by double digits. And yet, as you point out, every indicator suggests that they've made peace with Donald Trump. Again, I remember from your polls early in 2016, he had like an approval rating in the 20s in some of these these high Republican areas, and yet now he's at 95%. What's happening? How do you explain this phenomenon?
I think you can certainly see that there were shifts over that last election cycle and through now that make a lot of sense. If, you know, you wanted somebody else out of your party, you were really Trump skeptical, and so many voters were, and Ted Cruz won the state in the primary. But what we saw is after the convention in 2016, these folks that call themselves pure Republicans moved towards Trump. They became more favorable to him and peaked out by Election Day. People who call themselves independents, but then say, I lean Republican. That's a pretty faithful Republican group. They vote about 80 to 85% Republican, whereas the pure Republicans, it's in the 90s. So this is a pretty Republican group. They were slower to move. They did not move through most of the fall campaign, but they moved up in the last 3 weeks before the election. And both of those groups have only further increased their support for Trump once he took office. Democrats have not moved at all. Whether you're a pure Democrat or a leaning Democrat, there's no evidence of any sort of appeal for Trump there. And finally, the independents are net negative to Trump, but are less net negative today than they were during the 2016 campaign. So I think that part of this is coming home to party. It's my party's president. There's a lot of social pressure and rhetoric to join that train. There are certainly dissenters. I hear you've occasionally talked to some of them. But this is not unusual that a party reconciles itself in large measure to an incumbent president of the party. But it is still striking how skeptical the state was of him throughout 2015 and 16, and now how pretty solidly supportive they are right now among the Republican Party. There's obviously a big divide.
Now, among the key swing states, let's look at like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. What sets Wisconsin apart from those other states? Sure. I mean, one key fact is that we have a much higher portion of non-college educated voters, right?
That's right.
And a smaller minority population than, say, Pennsylvania and Michigan.
Right. First of all, the state is, depending on how you measure it, somewhere between 87 and 89% white among registered voters. It's a little less than that among all adults. So it's very white by comparison to the other two states. The other thing is the thing that has shifted in Wisconsin in the partisanship of white men without a college degree. In January of 2012, in the Marquette Law School poll, that group was 5 points more Republican than Democratic. But today, they are 18 points more Republican than Democratic, a 13-point shift over those years. No other group has moved to that extent. And as a result, the state as a whole has moved from about 31 Democratic to 27 Republican to today about 31 Republican, 30 Democratic. So the net effect has made us even more a evenly divided state.
So what's driving that? What are the issues that are driving white men away from the Democratic Party?
Well, I'll tell you an anecdote from a meeting I spoke to, and a union guy comes up to me, works in construction, and he says, I'm pro-union and I'm pro-gun. Who the hell am I supposed to vote for? Guns are not the only issue here. I don't want to make it too rarefied, but the idea that these union guys are divided in the issues that matter to them, and they don't hear a Democratic Party speaking to those interests. But at the same time, as with this guy, they also see a Republican Party that's not clearly on their side as well, at least in terms of the union membership side. So I think there is an issue of, I'm an old guy. I grew up in the 50s and 60s when the Democratic Party was the party of the working man. And you could see surveys, always people would say that as what's the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Republicans are for business. Democrats are for the working guy. You don't hear that anymore. And I think the evolution of the issue space within the parties, and especially within the Democratic Party, has focused on groups within the party other than these working class, white men especially. And it's a challenge for the party to decide to just concede the field and leave this group to Republicans, or how can Democrats establish an appeal with white working class voters that does not abandon the folks within the party that are also terribly important, the folks that don't fit in that category.
What about the gender gap in Wisconsin? What do you see?
The gender gap is really big, but it mostly comes because women have increasingly identified themselves as Democrats, and men more and more, as my example gave, as Republicans. When you look at views of Trump, for example, and you compare Republican men with Republican women, you only see a difference of 2 or 3 percentage points. When you do that with independents, you see a slightly bigger gap. And among Democrats, it's very negative for both groups. So you have to be careful when you talk about the gender gap. Are we considering gender alone, in which case there are big differences, or are we considering gender within partisanship, in which case partisanship accounts for most of those differences?
Now, I know that it's that, you know, we're early in the year and that we haven't had the much of a campaign, but I'm really struck by the your top line results that basically show no difference between the electability of, say, Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, and Bernie Sanders. I mean, it just seems like it doesn't matter. One of them's a socialist, one of them's a moderate, does not seem to show up. You know, give me your sense of that and how a campaign might change things. One thing that I've noticed in Wisconsin, based on your numbers over the years, is how few swing voters there generally are. That particularly when Scott Walker was running, it was really remarkable looking at the numbers, and there were virtually no undecided voters in the state of Wisconsin. So does the campaign move significant amounts of numbers, or is it going to be this kind of trench warfare through November?
I think within the Democratic Party, short-term success like South Carolina can move these numbers a fair bit. I think when we come to the fall, then the gap between Trump and whoever the Democratic nominee is will be so huge that there are relatively few swing voters. I do think that the perception at the time we were doing our poll was that we asked people who would be the strongest candidate against Trump. And Biden finished third in that listing in our survey. But now following the South Carolina result, I bet if we could do the survey instantly today, he would be much bigger. After tomorrow, who knows? And so I think this is something that actual performance in real contests with actual votes being cast will shift the views within the Democratic Party as we go forward. When we come to the fall, when I've looked at a matchup between Sanders and Trump, for example, about 2/3 of the voters have at least a 90% predicted probability of voting for their party's candidate. But there's about 10% that are really pretty much in the middle. They have 30 to 70% chances of voting for either candidate. And those are the folks that might move, but they're also the least predictable. They're also the least interested and involved in politics. They call themselves independents and moderates. They're younger. They pay less attention to politics. In other words, they're exactly the people that are the hardest for a campaign to successfully contact and shift. And from my point of view, they're also the hardest to predict in terms of where they might shift in the fall.
So the other thing that's hard to predict, of course, is what the turnout is going to be. And the Sanders campaign has been predicated on the belief that only he can turn out this massive, massive number of disengaged voters, including young people. Now, there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence that he's, in fact, done that right now. But what kind of when you model your polls, are you going to model it at different levels of turnout? I mean, how do you game that out? What is the art form there?
Well, there are multiple ways to do it. And one easy answer is you do it always and you see if it matters very much. In 2018, for example, we did do a full model. And when we released the results, took people through what a low turnout, middle turnout, high turnout would look like. And in 2018, it made almost no difference at all. But it is, and I was surprised by it, but 2018, as it turned out, was an exceptionally high turnout for a midterm in Wisconsin. Now, the presidential election will be even higher. The other thing that's special about Wisconsin is we routinely rank in the top three in the country, three states in the country with highest turnout levels. And so we're already close to maxing out turnout in the state. That doesn't mean there aren't pockets where turnout could be raised, certainly, but we are already high turnout, and in a presidential year, especially high turnout. To give you an example, we will have turnout in November of somewhere between 3 million and 3.1 million, and we only have about 3.3 or 3.4 million registered voters. So as a percentage of registered voters, we're already pushing the high 80s as a percent of total population. Of course, that's a good bit lower. So that's, again, where the Trump campaign has talked a lot about identifying supporters who aren't registered and getting them registered and getting them to the polls. That's, in theory, a place where you could stimulate turnout. But by definition, these are folks that in the past haven't been interested in voting. So it's kind of a heavy lift to actually get them to the polls.
Now, this is an important point. In places like Dane County and in some of the Wow County precincts, you have maxed out. There's no more votes there that you can get. Everybody basically turns out and votes. Okay, so for people who want to grow up to be Steve Kornacki, and maybe Steve will actually be listening to this podcast, so... in order to talk about Wisconsin, you've come up with sort of a mnemonic aid for the different areas of the state. The Wow counties being southeastern Wisconsin, Republican counties around Milwaukee County, Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington. What are the bad counties, the BAD counties?
Yeah.
So I want to do Wow and bad.
Yeah, that's up on the... Lake Superior, it's the far northern part of the state, and it's, now you're going to put me on the spot, B is Bayfield, A is Adams, and or Ashland, sorry, and D is Douglas County. You see why I needed the acronym.
Yeah,
I struggled to come up with this. They always are striking, and Steve will notice this from his maps or already knows it. They are typically blue counties there up north, surrounded by a sea of red in the rest of the northern part of the state. That's Sean Duffy's old 7th congressional district. But they always stand out as much more Democratic than the surrounding areas. They don't have a big population, but they are a significant chunk of that region of the state. Then the bow counties are Brown, Outagamie, and Winnebago, which are the Green Bay counties in Green Bay is in Brown County, and then Outagamie and Winnebago are just to the southwest of that. And they have exactly, and they have several medium-sized cities and suburbs. And those cities, like Appleton, have become substantially Democratic in their net votes, but they are surrounded by extremely Republican rural parts of those counties. So the net effect is they have become swing counties, but it's sort of because they're so divided, it's a question of which side gets the most votes out, not because they're moderate counties, but rather they're really deeply divided between the cities and the countryside.
Yes. So the bow, you pronounce it bow, right? B-O-W?
I do. Because I like to say bad bow wow.
Yeah. Okay. Bad Bow Wow. See, people can, this is how you can sound like an expert on Wisconsin politics. Okay. So those Bow counties, are rather substantial. They used to be considered kind of, they would go back and forth. They would be the bellwethers. They, at least in the presidential elections, trended, quite towards Trump, right? Republicans have done much better up there. The congressional seat that's held by Mike Gallagher used to be very much a swing seat going back and forth. And I think he won by, you know, mid 60s last time around. So this is another example of how rural Wisconsin, outside of southeastern Wisconsin, has been trending more Republican.
That's right. And it's the, you're right, that 8th congressional district is the swing district in the state, the only one that's really swung back and forth in partisan control in recent years. And it's a district that a Democrat wins and holds for a couple of elections before a Republican takes it back and holds it for longer. But it does have some swing to it. And traditionally, in close statewide elections, how those Bow counties swing has played a big role in the statewide result. So you still want to watch them very carefully. But again, to the north of those, you're seeing counties move solidly in a Republican direction. And that sort of offsets some of these swings that we're seeing in the counties that have a somewhat more urban population.
Yeah, you mentioned Sean Duffy's congressional district in northern Wisconsin, which has become really, again, moving toward the Republicans rather dramatically. And for historical wonks here, that was a congressional seat that was formerly held by Dave Obey for many, many years, actually forever. Dave Obey, one of the giants of the House Democrats, chairman of the Appropriations Committee. And there was a long time when it would have been inconceivable to think that Obey would have been replaced by a Republican. And now it's one of the most solidly Republican seats in the state of Wisconsin.
And it perfectly reflects this transition I'm talking about geographically and also in educational terms. It's a, you know, overwhelmingly white population in the district as well. Obey, if I remember right, took that seat in a special election after Mel Laird resigned to become defense secretary in the Nixon administration.
He did.
And as it turns out, I was holding a class on elections in which we were focused on Obey's seat and doing an analysis of how could a Republican win that seat. And I walked into class, and it was the day that Obey announced his retirement. So I thought we had focused on the right district. But at that moment, it looked like it was a bit of a challenge for a Republican to take
it
over.
It had already begun to switch.
But by the fall of 2010, it was no longer a challenge at all, and Duffy took it and held it convincingly.
No, it would have held it convincingly if he hadn't resigned. And of course, the Republicans are going to win that in a special election. But again, you've watched as Wisconsin. I mean, I certainly remember what it was like, before Election Day on 2010, when Democrats in Wisconsin controlled everything.
Yes.
They controlled both U.S. Senate seats. They controlled the governorship. They controlled both houses of the legislature. And the day after Election Day in 2010, they lost all of it.
Yeah,
they lost congressional seats. They lost both houses of the legislature, lost the governorship, lost a U.S. Senate seat, and never got it back, which is also rather extraordinary because I think in 2010, it maybe felt like this was a blip. This was a one-time event rather than this really secular change in the state of Wisconsin from blue to red.
I agree. You know this, but maybe some of the listeners don't. We have had a history of divided government at the state level. A governor has rarely had both houses of the legislature of their party. Tommy Thompson was elected 3 terms, and I think it was only 1 term he had a Republican legislature. That changed in 2010. Actually, the sequence of elections of 06 and 08, which were both big Democratic gains, gave the Democratic governor after 08 Democratic control of the legislature. Only 2 years later, it flipped back with Governor Walker and a Republican legislature and has stayed that way. But I think that sequence of elections shows under certain circumstances, which granted were pretty extreme with the recession coming and everything, how powerfully voters could shift the state initially in a Democratic direction and then change direction and come back in a Republican direction. And all of that happened without redistricting taking place in that period either. Now, it is certainly true that the districting is an advantage to Republicans in the state, but it also raises the question of when we have a next election in dramatic circumstances, the way 06 or 08 or 10 were, will the voters, in fact, provide a similarly kind of dramatic shift that installs a new majority or creates a majority that wasn't there before?
I forgot to ask you an earlier question that I think is rather important that I get asked all the time. So your numbers would suggest that Donald Trump's approval ratings have been ticking up. He's still competitive in Wisconsin. He certainly could win here in Wisconsin. It's a coin flip. So often I'm asked, well, what about the trade war and the impact on farmers? Dairy farmers aren't doing well. Wisconsin agriculture has been hurt, and yet that doesn't seem to be showing up in your numbers, does it?
No, it doesn't. And in fact, for the last 5 or 6 months, we've been specifically asking people if they own or work on a farm. So we've built up enough cases to now speak to that question. Of the people who are actively engaged in farming, they are neither more supportive of Trump nor less supportive of him than you would expect based on their party. And I say it that way because farmers are more Republican than the population as a whole. But if you look at Republican farmers and compare them to Republican non-farmers, the Trump approval number is less than one percentage point different. If you do it with Democrats, it's less than 1% different, but there's a vast gap between those two. Republican farmers in the 81% approval range, Democratic farmers at 6%. In our recent combined multi-month polling. It may be that objectively the farm economy has been hurt, but subjectively we're not seeing farmers either pro or anti compared to what you would expect them to be.
So this cultural affinity trumps the actual economic policy impact?
I think a lot of it is just lining up with party. I think, you know, there is a big question about real economic impact on the farmers and an important part. Who did they blame for that? A couple of years ago, it was Canada that changed their import policies on milk, and that raised a lot of ire among farmers in Wisconsin. I think the one other thing, though, to get in here is that the economy has been a big part of Trump's improved overall approval rating over the last 13 months. We've seen month to month minuscule improvements, 1 point this month, and then it sits and then it goes up another point next month. But the net effect is to take him from a 44 approval, 53 disapproval in January of 2019 to, in this latest survey in February, 48-48. Which is the best he's ever had since taking office in our data. And economic approval, that's been up in the 56% range. So there's a clear relationship there. Also, economic outlook, whether the next year will be better or worse, was actually net negative through August or September, but became strongly positive in the latter quarter or plus of the year. Now, of course, we're seeing a little bit of uncertainty about the economy. So keep your eye on that and see if voters who have become optimistic about the economy reverse course and what impact that has on Trump's approval numbers, both for the economy specifically and whether it ripples over into overall job approval.
And of course, in Wisconsin, even the movement of a few points could be, have tremendous implications. Charles Franklin, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thanks for
having me. Appreciate it very much. Charles Franklin runs the Marquette University Law Poll. For those of you who are interested in anything involving Wisconsin or where those electoral votes are going, that is the poll to follow. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. We will be back tomorrow on Super Tuesday, and we will do this all over again.